Welcome to the Wise Women Diaries podcast. This is where shame and victimhood die. I am a woman that questions everything, so this podcast is a reflection of that. Here, we speak on non-mainstream perspectives, like how children are the biggest teachers, how to turn pain to wisdom, and the journey of learning to trust ourselves. We discuss what it looks like to own our power as a woman and question the medical paradigm. That's why I am obsessed with interviewing women who trust their bodies and babies in home birth and free birth. Ultimately, this podcast is for women who question the status quo, but are dedicated to thriving and learning how to take radical responsibility for their life and shed victimhood for good.
Hi, I'm Ellen. I am a wife, a mom to a two-year-old girl, and an ex-techie turned hypnotherapist. One of my deepest fascinations in life is the art and the science of how to become friends with your own mind. And that is probably because my mind used to be my own worst enemy. Years ago, I vividly remember experiencing a life that was really filled with doubt and worry and just this intense fear of judgment. And I felt like my very analytical, very deep mind was like this stallion that would just run wild, and I was just along for the ride. I'm also a 5-1 projector in human design. So the drive to really just make sense out of the world in a way that is meaningful and to solve problems is core to who I am. And so with all of this being said, the problem solver within me set out on this path to create a better life for myself, starting with the thoughts that I was having day in and day out. So over the last decade, I've trained in yoga while living in an ashram in India. I became a certified One Giant Mind meditation teacher, a rapid transformational therapy practitioner and hypnotherapist. And all of these modalities, they speak to this passion in really helping people to just dive within themselves. And right now, because I'm a mom, I feel so called to helping other moms heal trauma, heal self-limiting beliefs, all of these negative thought patterns, all through the lens of neuroscience, the quantum, the subconscious mind. So thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here. And I think we're going to dive into some really juicy stuff today.
Yeah, you had me at becoming a friend with your own mind. That is probably one of my biggest passions because our mind is with us our entire life. And if we're at war with our own mind, we're at war with everything in life. This is one of my favorite conversations. But first, I want to ask you to dispel the myths about hypnotherapy because I find it really fascinating that some people are really ignorant and just shut it down and think it's like evil or devil or something when they don't know anything about it.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation about hypnosis, what it is, what it isn't. I think that, you know, so many people, what they've been exposed to are the high school graduation parties where people are being, you know, they're doing all these crazy, silly things up on a stage where the stuff that you see on TV or Las Vegas, it can be very fearful to see that happen and think like, oh my gosh, are these people like completely out of control? These shows can really make it seem that way. But what hypnosis truly is, especially through the lens of the work that I do, is it's just a state of deep inner absorption. It is a state of mind where you are so deeply aware of everything that is going on within you, and you're able to really unlock these conversations with yourself and have access to information that you wouldn't readily be able to tap into as, you know, a part of daily life. And so with my background being, you know, coming up into this career through the path of yoga and meditation, I look at hypnosis very much as an extension of meditation, where we have been able to relax so deeply and tune inward so much, we're actually in more control than we've ever been.
I do want you to talk about what people are accessing during hypnotherapy, because that's where people get afraid and fearful. And the myths around hypnotherapy, people shut things down because of fear.
Yeah. So to me, hypnotherapy, what you're accessing is your subconscious, your subconscious and unconscious. So there's different layers of the mind. Your waking state, your daily kind of, I'm moving through life, I'm awake, I'm engaged, I'm aware, that's your beta brainwave. And then beneath that, as we slow down the frequencies of the brain, we move into states of awareness where we are less, you know, engaged with the world, the external world around us. And we start to become more internally engaged. And so we're shifting from a state of beta to then alpha. Alpha's like a sort of an idle brainwave state where, you know, maybe you would look at this as, you know, you've got your eyes closed. You are in a light state of meditation. And then below that, we've got theta. And this is typically what people associate with dreaming, or with that state that we go into just before we're about to fall asleep. So we're kind of awake, we're kind of asleep. The thing with this is that most people, they think that, well, if I'm dreaming, I'm asleep, I'm not aware, I'm unconscious. But that's not true. We can tap into that state of creativity, of, you know, deep rest within our nervous system, within our body, of intuition, all while still remaining conscious. Some people do this with like practices such as transcendental meditation. Other people do this with breath work. Hypnosis is just another tool, very similar to that, that brings you into that theta brainwave state. It's a very, very natural state of being, and it is actually such a core fundamental piece of moving your body into a place where it's no longer fighting and resisting and living in stress, but it's actually able to shift into a state of healing where there's harmonious things happening within all systems, all functions of the body. And so it's not just about working with, you know, the mind and the subconscious, our emotions, but it's like bringing the body into that just beautiful place where things can, you know, you're moving out of your own way.
Yeah. What about bringing up the concept that young children are in these brainwave states, basically of hypnosis? That's why their subconscious is being programmed from about the ages from 0 to 7. We don't have a lot of conscious memories from this time, but everything is being downloaded, everything from ages 0 to 7, and obviously onwards, but that's like the main programming time of the subconscious mind, that everything we are experiencing during that time is being downloaded into our brain. That's why we become adults. And we find ourselves reacting to these weird situations, usually with our own children, if you're a parent. We find ourselves reacting to these weird situations. And if you're curious, you go inwards and you're like, why did I react like that? You can find a pinpoint from your past, from either your parents' reaction or an experience when you were a child that's lodged deep in your subconscious. And you're not even aware of it, but your body remembers and your subconscious brain knows, and you react from the subconscious mind as an adult. And that's a lot of what your work is working with women specifically on, I keep acting this way and I don't want to, but it's so hard to change it.
Yes, 100%. You nailed it. So essentially, as the brain is developing, as it's evolving, first, the only brainwave state that children have access to is that theta brainwave. And so from the ages of 0 to 7, children live life permanently in that theta brainwave state, which is why they are so, so suggestible. They believe literally everything that you tell them. They believe in Santa Claus. They, you know, whatever it is. And they take things at face value. And this, so if you ever want to get curious about how your subconscious mind actually works and actually operates, just watch your kid, how they live and function throughout daily life. This is a world of creativity and imagination.
Their presence, they don't live in the past and they don't live in the future. They're only in the present.
Yeah. And so when I talk about how hypnosis can make you more suggestible to receiving new beliefs in such a powerful way, and in a way where just reciting different affirmations to yourself consciously it's that same idea of like children, they're in this theta brainwave, they have this sponge-like brain, and they're just in the most profound, powerful state of learning. That's what hypnosis is. And then, we start to dive into the imprint that all of these experiences that we've had throughout life and what they've done sort of within our subconscious bedrock. And we can start to say, oh, okay, as I'm observing myself in daily life and I'm noticing this thing come up, how can I maybe reflect that back to my upbringing and some of the experiences that I had? And we can start to kind of make sense out of things in a deeper way.
Yeah, my husband and I have constant conversations and awareness over little behaviors we do in the house that was like, oh my gosh, that was my mom. Oh my gosh, I just did that. And that's what exactly my dad would do. And it even goes down to something so silly as when we have our burger and fries nights, we go pick it up from the drive-thru. On the way home, one of us eats fries on our way to the house and the other doesn't because of what our parents did.
Yeah. And it's everything. It's such, that's why the neuroscience says that 95% of who we are, our thoughts, our feelings, our behaviors, our personality traits, all of these little things like eating fries on the way home from the drive-thru, we pick up on that stuff. And that is all a product of the subconscious, and it's driving 95% of our experience in daily life. And so this is why things like all of these subconscious practices are so powerful, and people are starting to shift away from a lot of the traditional forms of, you know, maybe talk therapy or whatever, because you're just able to tap into things at such a deep level, create change that ripples out into daily life, where we're actually noticing shifts in how we show up to daily life.
Yeah, let's get into some of the patterns you notice being a mom to a toddler. What type of patterns do you see on your daily or have throughout your 2-year mother journey so far that you have traced back, or just it comes from a limiting belief?
I think that when you become a parent, you are forced to face so many things from your past, because your child is like the greatest teacher in life that you will ever have. And they will inevitably bring up things within you that you probably haven't dealt with. at least not, you know, fully or in the same way. The things that come up a lot, I think for me personally, oh my gosh, when I was postpartum, there was just this program of high expectations playing out and needing to be productive. And I had already done so much healing work in that space, in the space of perfectionism and the space of, you know, deriving your own worth from how productive you are. And when I was in the stages of, you know, you're just, you feel like a milk factory, you're around the clock feeding, your whole life is all about just caring for your newborn. And maybe this expectation that I unknowingly, subconsciously put upon myself that I was going to be able to accomplish all of these things within my business. And I was going to be able to keep the house in, you know, clean, tidy shape. And it just didn't happen. And I feel like I had to go through this whole thing of like, oh my gosh, it's coming up again. And I have to really be so gentle with myself and renegotiate all of these things and not let any of it mean anything about how worthy I am, how enough I am, how successful I may or may not be. That was one just personally that really came through. Another one is just the tantrums, feeling that I feel like probably every parent has been slapped in the face by their own kid, but oh, the rage that a moment like that can bring up within you, the disrespect, how dare you? But when we have done the work to really just approach those situations from a place of empathy, compassion, understanding that my child is having really big emotions. And this is the only way that they know how to express those right now. We can choose something differently than, you know, meeting them with a similar reactive sort of outburst or getting really, really frustrated or upset about what had just happened. So yeah, those just the big emotions and all the triggers that that brings up. And then the other one is just so much pressure to be a good mom and the mom guilt and the just all of these things. And so much of that is also, I feel, societal, like a lot of this subconscious imprinting. It's not just what we were brought up around and in our family life, but it comes from school. It comes from just how the world operates, and everything is so fast paced. And many women, many moms, like conditions that you have to raise a child in are not ideal. And that can be really tough too.
What about speaking to any patterns you see with your clients, maybe women specifically with in regards to parenthood or just broadly like women's issues of the subconscious that you deal with?
So just to give some context to anyone listening, as a hypnotherapist, one of the things that I do within every session is we kind of start with a specific challenge, something that the client is really wanting to understand better and really heal and work through. And from there, I will guide them back once they're in this state of hypnosis to a scene, a memory, an experience, a moment in time that has all to do with this challenge that they're wanting to look at. So the client will start to talk about, okay, I'm in a scene, or I'm getting flashes of scenes that have to do with me being in cheerleading and dance, and there's rehearsals and practice and competitions, and the pressure to perform is just so intense. And I just feel like I'm being constantly compared to, and I'm not good enough, or I'm being compared to my sibling because of how they look or what they do or the straight A's that they got. or I'm 5 years old and I'm at parent teacher conferences and I'm hearing my teacher tell my mom how great of a student that I am. And she said something like, oh, is she this perfect at home? And my mom said, of course not. And she like laughed and I'm feeling so just embarrassed or surprised or rejected. And so there's just these really vivid details, a very specific moment. And it tends to be just a lot of very simple daily life moments where I'm not feeling good enough. I'm feeling unseen, unheard, like I don't matter. I'm invisible. No one cares. Dad was too busy. He forgot to pick me up at soccer practice and I had to wait there with the coach for an hour. I want to say all of that with this loving reminder that we're not perfect as parents. And there will be moments where we maybe lose our tempers or we screw up, and that is absolutely okay. But it's more about just the things that tend to occur over and over and over again. Oh, Dad missed dinner again for the third night in a row because he's working too late.
Yeah, the repetitiveness, but also I think a lot of those stories, the child felt so alone and there wasn't a safe connection with a parent to talk about what happened. And that's what I think a lot of conscious parents are doing now, are creating this connection of safety so that even if a big or little event happens where the child feels really abandoned or rejected, that the child can process it healthily with the parent. And that's what we, most of us, didn't have in childhood just because the consciousness wasn't there.
I will tell you that that is the common denominator in pretty much all of these scenes. It doesn't matter what it was, the magnitude or the severity. The common denominator is that they didn't have a safe space to land. They didn't feel like they could express or that they were helped in expressing what they needed to feel, or that their emotions simply were too much for the parent. And so this is where a lot of kids, they grow up feeling like they have to be the parent too soon, too early. I have to now manage my parents' emotions. I'm responsible for how they're feeling instead of vice versa. So that is absolutely a huge factor.
So I think that's really reassuring to any parent listening, because it's just fostering that safe, healthy connection with your child so that they can come to you. And that's done through all these little moments of the everyday.
Yeah. And there's been so many studies on resilience, also studies in adverse childhood experiences and trauma. And what the data shows is that when there was a supportive system at home within the family, or even outside of the family, the teacher who cared, the community at church, the friend, the aunt, whatever it was, someone for that child to go to, that is one of the factors that is most important when it comes to diminishing the impact of a significant life event. So it doesn't necessarily matter what you experience, what life threw at you. If you have that support, that core foundational support to process whatever that thing was, studies show that that is what is the key factor in being resilient.
I love that Gabor Mate talks about that a lot, that it's children alone in their pain. It's children alone without that safe connection. And I think all of us can relate to it if we have a romantic partner, because if we're dealing with something really challenging at work or with our children, and say we did not have the safe connection to go to our spouse with that, how isolating that is, that's massive. That's huge. And we can all relate to that.
Yeah. Surrounding yourself with good people, feeling like you have a community that you can turn to when life gets challenging is huge. And then to layer on top of that is that, you know, we as adults have the ability to support ourselves in a way that children don't. When you're a kid, you rely on your parent, you rely on your caretakers to provide that mental, emotional, physical nourishment and support for you. But when you're an adult, you have now developed into a space where you can use the power of your own mind, your own beliefs, your own thoughts to also back you up. And that's why it's so important, I say, that, you know, make your mind your own best friend, because your husband, your coworker, your boss, whoever it may be, they might not be able to hold space for you or support you in the way that you need. But if the voice inside of your head is supportive, that's really powerful. And that can help pull you through so many difficult, challenging moments or just basic daily life things. You know, I've got a presentation at work. I am, you know, applying for a new job. My kid is sick. And there's a diagnosis and I need to advocate for them. It doesn't matter what it is. Working with your mind and the predominant thoughts that play out over and over again, making them supportive, kind, helpful, encouraging. Couldn't we all use more of that, especially as parents, especially as mothers? And I think one thing that we forget, we don't always realize, is that it works in the opposite way too, where we could have the most supportive community around us, but if the voice inside your head is a total, complete enemy, you know, tearing you down no matter what.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because that is one of the biggest points ever, because in my experience with my own mind, I consider myself pretty self-aware, where on the daily, I'm watching the things I'm talking about and pretty conscious of how I reply and respond to people and how I interact with people. I'm very conscious of 90% of what I do, maybe. And I watch my own mind dangle the carrot of blaming someone for something, dangle the carrot of being a victim to this or that, dangle the carrot of a fear spiral. Oh my gosh, I need to be afraid of this today because everyone keeps posting about this certain thing on social media. I need to look into this. I need to research it. My mind is constantly dangling carrots for me to spiral in victimhood, in poor me. And that is dangling in front of me all the time, because that's what the mind does a lot of the time. And I personally think that's the function of the mind. We have that part of ourselves, but where my power is not listening to it and not acting from it. I have the most crazy thoughts ever. I have weird thoughts, but and fearful thoughts, but I don't take the bait. And that's where my power is. I'm not a different person. I know everyone has fearful thoughts. It's just I create my value system of not living my life in fear. I have the fear thoughts, but I just don't allow myself to act from the fear. And that's where our responsibility as adults live.
Yeah, it goes back to that story or that metaphor of choosing which wolf you want to feed. It is such a part of being a human to experience difficult emotions, to get caught up in fear-based thinking, because again, like that is that function of the unconscious and subconscious mind. It is not the part of your brain that is centered around helping you thrive in life. Its pure focus is survival. And so that's why we feel like there's all these carrots dangling in front of us. And there's this tendency to want to jump into that, I got to stay safe, I got to protect myself, I got to seek out pleasure, I got to avoid pain. It's primitive and it's a natural thing. It happens for everybody. And I feel it happens a lot, especially if you are a mother, because now you're not just trying to keep yourself alive. You've got children. And in many ways, that instinct is more powerful than anything. And so, yeah, it's just recognizing, okay, what am I going to give my power to today? What am I going to give my power to in this moment? And to me, that's what mindfulness is. That's what well-being is. It's how do I make a choice moment to moment to moment to moment that has my long-term best interest in mind versus the short-term knee-jerk reactive thing that I could easily default to in this moment.
Let's go back to when you were explaining your patients in their chair saying, when I was a cheerleader and the pressure to perform and I was left at soccer practice, these memories, how do they show up in their adult life? Because they're coming up in hypnotherapy to show that it's kind of like the core of a pattern that has been persistent throughout their life.
Looking at healing these emotional wounds or reconstructing a behavioral pattern, whenever you go back to a memory and experience, and your subconscious will take you there whenever you move into these types of practices, whether it be meditation, hypnosis, journaling, breath work, whatever, the mind will naturally draw you to these things. What's so important to remember is that it's not the experience itself that we're so interested in picking apart all of the details on. It's the meaning that we made out of it. And so with all of these different examples, we go straight to the emotion and straight into the belief. What belief did this lead me to create about myself, about the way that the world works? What effect did it have on my self-identity, my self-esteem, my self-worth, my self-value? And then we can start to look at that, because that is the program that will then get sort of copy and pasted onto all of these daily life situations, especially when there is some sort of underlying similarity in the emotion or the situation. And that's the trigger. That's the thing of like, oh, I don't know what's going on right now, but I'm feeling all of this stuff coming up. Somewhere within the mind, there's been an association that has been made. And so we can start to dive into, okay, what's the story here? What is the story that I'm creating about this thing that's happening now as an adult, you know, as a mom, for example? I really wanted to have this type of birth. I tried everything that I could to plan, prepare. I did all of the things, right? And then for whatever reason, my body just didn't perform, right? There's that performance thing coming up, or that not good enough thing coming up. And then we start to take that experience and make it mean something about who we are. And that's just one example. But, you know, we can maybe it's another thing like, okay, our kid is having a really big emotion. They're tantruming in the middle of the grocery store. You start to feel really judged or embarrassed. Oh my God, people are looking at us. You have to stop what you're doing, stop feeling, be quiet, or we got to like rush out of here. Did your kid make you feel that way? Or was this something coming up from inside of you that really made you feel so afraid of judgment? So we can start to kind of see how this ripples out into all these situations in parenthood and in how we parent too, you know, because I think a lot of us, we were raised with parents who didn't have all the access to this type of information, to this knowledge. They were taught something completely different about parenting. And a lot of that involved very harsh, you know, discipline, punishment, yelling, threatening, and stuff can still come up, even though on an intellectual level, we've said, I don't want to do that. I don't believe in that. I never want to treat my kid that way. The emotional knee-jerk reaction, that's where that's coming from.
Yeah, this really shows up in close, intimate, romantic relationships, right? All of the messaging from our childhood gets brought up in these intimate relationships. And one of the most common scripts that I love, Dr. Sue Johnson, she's my favorite marriage therapist. She has a few books. My favorite book is Hold Me Tight. And she very blatantly says, in all of the couples I've ever worked with, these are the scripts that come with either a man or a woman or same sex, whatever, but a two partners together. One partner typically feels you don't care enough. I am not treasured and adored enough because I need to provoke, poke, criticize, attack. I need to provoke you to see whether you care about me. Do you care about me? And so this criticizing, poking.
Or why do I have to ask? Why should I have to ask about, you know, XYZ thing? You should just know. You should just do it because you love me.
Totally. And so there's this script of, you don't care enough about me. And usually that script goes back to childhood. And for me, my dad died when I was 12 and then my mom was grieving. So I was emotionally abandoned. But before that, I was the middle child of six kids. So I was very overlooked. Like emotional apathy is my biggest childhood thing. And then I went out into the world and chose a partner that reminded me of emotional apathy. Like I have to provoke him. Our 17-year relationship is that I have to provoke him to see, okay, do you care about me? Do you care about me? So I'm that partner. Do you care enough? And everything you do, it's just not enough. I don't see that you care enough. And then on the opposite side, the other partner usually is, whatever I do is not good enough. And so this is the limiting belief they took from their childhood, usually because they had a very controlling parent or a very criticizing parent that just rode them, you know, demanded perfection or performance, and the child could never live up to it. And so the child got the messaging, whatever I do is not good enough. So then he went out into the world and found a partner that is more critical and controlling, and that felt familiar to his nervous system because it felt familiar because it was one of his parents. And so we clung together through these limiting beliefs, and they have played out for 17 years. And now we're very aware of them. We've been aware of them for about 8 years. But I still watch it happening all the time. You know, you're on your phone. All I want is eye contact. Okay. You can't possibly care about me if you're on your phone while I'm talking, right? Like, and then anything I say, you know, he's like, oh, not good enough. And it's just back and forth, back and forth. And we're aware of it, but it's still present because it's our subconscious and it's a part of who we are. And now more so how we handle it is basically just narrating. When you're doing this behavior, I literally feel like you don't care when you're doing this behavior. And so now we're just trying not to react from that space. It's just a story in our mind. But it's also how we feel because it's so weaved into our childhood and who we are. And we lived our relationship that way for so many years too. So my question is, if you're dealing with patients with marriage compatibility or incompatibility issues, what have you seen come up in this regard?
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you spoke about partnership, because I think that's maybe one thing that I haven't brought up yet. And what you were saying about these sort of like core patterns that people have. There's, I'm not good enough. I feel like I'm not being seen and now I need to provoke you. It all kind of stems back to how we get attention, how we get validation, and how we get acceptance. We either overachieve and excel in everything we do because that gets us noticed. We have to feel like we need to maybe rebel or be difficult. And that can be a big way that children seek attention is, you know, they're the troublemaker or they're making people laugh or being the class clown. There's also caretaking. And this is a big thing that comes up for a lot of moms is I had to take care of all my siblings. My parents were sick. I was the caretaker. Mom and dad told me how much they loved me whenever I helped them because, you know, they were alcoholics and I took care of them on the couch when they were hungover or whatever. And so now they're still the caretaker and they're just people pleasing and doing everything, prioritizing everyone else's needs over their own. And then they're feeling resentful, depleted, exhausted. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And to add to that, those are just a couple more of those kind of core patterns that come up from those sort of like wounded aspects of ourselves or our past.
I want to bring up this Kelly Brogan quote. I think it goes something like, when someone is being generous to be praised or thanked, it's fake generosity because you're just doing it to try to get validation. It's not out of the warmness of your heart. And that's, I think, why so many women get resentful is because they're like, do you see me? Do you see me doing all this work? Do you see me? Do you see all this emotional work I'm doing? Do you see all of the, you know, behind the stage background of all the work that's required to be a mother? Do you see that? Do you see me?
Yeah. And then it creates this feeling of like, I'm not supported. And this is where we get to kind of step back and we get to look at the situation from the angle of, okay, have I maybe, and this is where it's kind of a tough pill to swallow, because this is where we have to step out of a state of victimhood and into a state of, how have I created the life that I am living? Even if it was on a subconscious level, something I didn't know I was choosing or inviting or attracting into my life. So a prime example is the man-child husband who just isn't showing up for all of the housework, all of the mental and emotional labor that takes place within a family and, you know, raising kids and keeping all of the things in order with the house and whatever it may be. And a lot of times it's a product of what I see a lot is the mom who for so many years, they won't give up control. They won't delegate. They automatically assume all of the duties within the house and sort of allow their partner to not take part in a more equal way or in a way that feels more balanced. And then kids come into the picture and it just starts to snowball. And then all of a sudden, the mom is in a state and a place where they're in that, you know, I'm resentful. And the husband has fallen into a place where they're just coasting. So we have to ask ourselves, what is it about me that has created that dynamic? How does that sort of trace back to how I receive and how I seek validation, acceptance, and love from the world around me? And so that's where we get into sort of like a root cause solution to the problem, where we're no longer showing up from a place of tit for tat, I need you to do this, why can't, and just nagging, to, okay, I've actually changed my self-worth, and that has shifted how I operate. I have now called up my partner to a space where he's either got to rise to the occasion and meet me in this place, or what happens a lot is they start to become actually sort of repelled. And they're now in a space where they're like, I'm no longer attracted to that. So it's super powerful stuff.
It is. Thank you so much for bringing that up, because there are some women that have the man-child husband and they're like, oh, it is what it is. And they don't complain about it. And I'm like, oh, that's great. You accept the situation. But then there's women that enable it and complain about it. And they're not in the space of taking responsibility for their 50% role. Because in a marriage, in a partnership, it's 50-50. Your life and the dynamics that's happening is 50% your responsibility. And it's women that are usually, I think, not willing to let go of something. And it's probably usually control, because it's so scary. It's so scary.
Yeah, or there's a lack of trust that their partner will be able to, especially when the kids are involved, you know, can I trust them to go to the doctor's office with my three-year-old or whatever it may be? Yeah, that's hard. It's a really sticky, tough place to be in. It's not easy to move through this stuff. Like you and I were talking about it, like, oh, like, yeah, you just change your beliefs and you just do these other things. But it's hard, but it's worth it.
Yeah. And you're bringing up the biggest piece in relationships, which is trust. And a lot of people don't think about it this deep. They're like, I trust my husband won't cheat on me. It's like, no, you can't even trust your husband to take your child to the doctor alone. You don't actually trust your own husband. And that is why there are so many issues. And then I would argue there's also this piece that you don't respect them. You don't trust them because you don't actually respect them. And that's a very scary truth to face. But if you actually want change, you have to be honest with yourself about this.
Yeah. And then just to take that even deeper is this philosophical idea, which I deeply believe in, and that is that everyone is a mirror. And what I see in them is sort of a direct representation of what is really going on within myself. And if I can't trust them, then do I really trust? You know what I mean? So it's like there's a lot of opportunity to look at these really sort of basic daily life situations and understand more about ourselves and our patterns and our relationships. And
yeah, the way I see it is, if we're not aware of this stuff, we just lie to ourselves and we're like, yeah, I trust my husband. And then when we start wanting to understand our partnerships, our relationship with ourselves, our subconscious, when we want to understand, that's when like the truths are revealed. It's like layer after layer, like, oh, okay, I don't actually trust my husband. I've been saying I do because I haven't been willing to look at the truth. But like I said, when we are willing to be honest with ourselves, that's when actual change can happen. Because if you're not aware, there's nothing to change.
Yeah. That's why this process of, you know, conscious parenting, going through a healing journey, becoming more self-aware, it's so easy to avoid it because you will be faced to confront some stuff that's pretty uncomfortable. Like this is that dark, shadowy stuff. And it's not easy to kind of call yourself out in that way. It's so much easier to just put it out on everybody else. They're the problem. It's the world. It's whatever, my boss. And that is, it can make us maybe feel a little bit better in the moment, but it's really just burying what's actually going on. And yeah, I think that is why whenever you are doing this type of work, you have to just give yourself so much grace and so much empathy, so much self-compassion, because it takes a lot of courage, a lot of bravery to kind of get down on your hands and knees and just sift through the mud and break these cycles and really try to create a different state of being within your home, within your life. Yeah, it's tough, and you are doing great.